Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk about the history of bodybuilding. We also talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and I'm your host, John Hansen, and happy 2020. We are, of course, now in the new year of the new decade, 2020. So I hope everybody's having a wonderful new year. I finally got over my cold that I had last week, so hopefully you can understand me a little bit better. And on today's show, we're still getting over the holidays, so still lining up some interviews for the new year. So we are going to do part two of our second anniversary, or our 2.5 year anniversary, I guess, because we started on July 4th. So we got some great clips today of some other shows that we've done over the last year and a half that you probably have heard. Included on the show today, we've got our Ed Corney tribute. Ed Corney passed away about a year ago. I think he passed away on January 1st of 2019. Ed passed away, and we did, of course, a tribute to Ed Corney because he was one of the greatest bodybuilders ever, a true legendary bodybuilder. We're starting off our anniversary show today talking to Roger Schwab, who was the head judge at the Mr. Olympia back in the late 1970s, and we're going to talk a little bit about Ed Corney and this clip we're going to play. We're also going to talk to Pat Neave on the show, and Pat Neave had a great career. He was the 1974 AAU Mr. USA overall winner. So he's going to talk about meeting Arnold. We got a few clips from Boyer Coe. Boyer's always one of my favorite guests, and he has some really great stories. We talked to him, I think, in the last year and a half. Last year, in 2019, one of the most treasured interviews, I guess you could say, was Jeff King, who was the 1983 Mr. America winner. Jeff hasn't been heard from in the bodybuilding world for years, probably maybe 20 years. So it was great to get an interview with Jeff King. I want to thank my friend Larry Bernstein for setting that up, because Larry used to train and compete with Jeff. Not really trained with him, but he used to compete with him back in the 80s. And Larry was from Illinois, so I knew Larry from Chicago. We're also going to have some clips from our Ken Sprague interview. Ken Sprague, of course, was the owner of Gold's Gym back during the golden era in the 1970s when they made pumping iron. So Ken had some really, really great stories. So we're going to hear from him also. All right, before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand I use, trust, and associate my name with. It's the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe in 2012. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner, Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is their two-stage pre-workout, or Vintage Brawn, which is the triple protein isolate powerhouse. It's packed with eggs, milk, and beef protein. Their products have no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. Old School Labs is also the home of 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 when you go to their website, oldschoollabs.com, and they will give you 12% off your order just because you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right. By the time you guys hear this, I am going to be in Hawaii. I'm going out to Maui, Hawaii, to celebrate my parents' wedding anniversary. They have been married now 60 years. January 30th is their wedding anniversary. We got married in 1960, and I'm very grateful and blessed that my parents are still with me and still with us, and they're very happy and very healthy. So they usually go out to Hawaii every other year. They like to travel a lot. They like to vacation a lot. I've never gone, so I'm going to go this year because it is a big occasion with their 60th wedding anniversary. So I'll be out there for a week, but I will be back next week, and we'll probably have another anniversary special. That'll be our last one, where I'll get together some more clips of the last 2.5 years of our broadcast on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So I'll let you guys know how that trip goes. I'm looking forward to that. I'm still training, so I'm going to train out there. I think there's a powerhouse gym in Maui. I'm going to go there, so I'm going to enjoy it. Enjoy my time with my parents, and enjoy my time in paradise. I also want to mention, of course, the seminar that I have coming up. I talked about this the last couple of weeks, And this is going to be set for March 21st and 22nd out in Tampa, Florida. It is going to be at the Powerhouse Gym where I train. So if you're interested in going, I'm only going to take 15 people for the seminar. And the reason for that is the seminar is going to be a combination of a classroom setting where we're going to talk about training and nutrition and all aspects of bodybuilding. It's going to be over 2 days. The second part of the seminar is a training seminar where we're actually going to go into the gym and I'm going to go over all the best exercises to do for each body part. So we're going to do half the body one day and half the body the next day. And so, of course, with that type of setup, we can't have too many people. Otherwise, we won't be able to give everybody the individual one-on-one attention that the seminar is going to need. So we're only going to limit it to 15 people. So the cost for the two-day seminar, it'll probably be like 8 hours, 9 hours each day, is $495. And if you sign up on my website, johnhansonfitness.com, you can get it for that price before February 1st. After February 1st, the price is going to go up to $595. So if you're thinking about going and you want to make the trip out to Tampa, Florida, go to my website, johnhansonfitness.com. Sign up as soon as possible because, like I said, once we get 15 people, the classroom will have to be closed. And hopefully I will do another one of these in the future, but I don't know when or I don't know where. So if you want to go to Tampa and you're stuck in one of those winter areas, I just watched the news. A lot of places in the East Coast are getting killed with the weather. So if you want to go up, get away from the winter, Tampa in March is beautiful. It's like about 85, low humidity. It's just gorgeous. And we got some of the greatest beaches out here too. So make a little vacation of it and you come out. And plus you'll get my 40 years of experience with bodybuilding. I've been doing this since I was 14 and I'm going to turn 57 in March. So been around a long time, been doing this a long time. And this is the first extensive two-day seminar I've ever done. So I'm really looking forward to it. I'm getting all my notes together. It's really, really going to be great. So I hope you guys can make it if you're interested in that. The other thing I got going on is the John Hansen Fitness Challenge, which starts on January 20th, which will be next week. And it's going to be a 12-week challenge. I'm going to write up everybody who enters the contest. I'm going to write up their diet and their training program, and I'm going to be their coach for 12 weeks. So unlimited emails. I'll check in with you each week, and I will help you to get into the best shape of your life. And out of all the people that go in it, at the end of the program, which will be April 13th, at the end of the 12 weeks, we're going to look at everybody's before and after pictures, and we're going to pick three winners, first, second, and third. They're going to get supplements from Old School Labs. They're going to get my DVDs, which is the Real Muscle DVD, which was a training DVD, and then also my other DVD, which is Natural Bodybuilding Seminars and Competitions, which is basically a big two-hour seminar that I put on film. You're also going to get my books, the Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends, Volume 1, the MP6 Workout, and Diary of a Natural Bodybuilder. So that is the chance you take. You can win some prizes, and you're also going to get in great shape. It's a win-win situation, so I hope you guys take advantage of it. The cost to enter the contest is $300, and with that $300, you will get my coaching for 12 weeks, plus you'll get a workout and a diet program written up by me, and I will send that out to you before the thing starts. So you have to sign up by the 15th, which is only a couple days away. So if you're interested, go to johnhansonfitness.com, click on the fitness challenge link, and you can sign up for that right away. And I will have your program to you before the contest starts on the 20th. And I'm really hoping, we got a lot of entries in the last week. So I'm really hoping this thing takes off and get a lot of people in shape. It's going to be a lot of fun. So I hope you guys are, if you're interested in that, go to johnhansonfitness.com. I also do online coaching now too. So the website is now up. It's all johnhansonfitness.com. We got it up for the new year and it's really, really looking good. So if you're interested in losing fat, getting ready for a contest, we have yearly programs on there. We've got it all on there. So I hope you'll check that out. All right, before we get to our second part of our second anniversary show, I also want to mention our other sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn body fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results that you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, flalternativemeds.com. Again, the number 813-922-8939, or go to their website, flalternativemeds.com. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. You'll get a free consultation, and you will get 20% off your order. All right, that's it for our opening. Here is our second part of our second anniversary show, where we're going to show clips from the last 2.5 years of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Hope you enjoy it. All right, we're going to start off our second anniversary show. This is part two, of course, with a clip from our Ed Corney tribute. As I mentioned, Ed Corney passed away last year on January 1st, 2019. So we, of course, we did a tribute to Ed Corney on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And one of the guests that we had on was Roger Schwab. And Roger was a head judge with the IFBB in the late 70s during the golden era of bodybuilding. And Roger and I both got a chance to see Ed pose at the 1977 Mr. Olympia contest, which was one of the greatest Mr. Olympias I ever saw. Ed got, I think, 2 standing ovations or 3 standing ovations that day. It was just electrifying to see his posing routine. So in this clip, Roger and I reminisce about Ed Corney at the 1977 Mr. Olympia.
But getting back to Corney, it was interesting that you say that Corney's popularity grew so explosively from the movie, but exactly the opposite happened for a great physique of Ken Waller, who, because of the movie and through no fault of his own, became the villain because of the whole Mike Katz stage stage episode, which really was, you know, part of, you know, just the drama of the movie. But Waller was also, even though in tremendous shape in the early 70s, looking really good in the mid 70s, but yet he couldn't overcome the role that he had in that movie, which I think was a disservice to a great physique.
Very unfortunate.
As good as Ed Corney was in 76, the first time I saw him, 77 was the greatest posing routine that, in my opinion, ever occurred at any level, professional and amateur. I think Chris Dickerson learned an awful lot from watching Ed Corney pose, because Dickerson's posing in the very early 80s was very similar to Corney's, but it did not quite match the extreme brilliance of what Corney was able to do that night.
Yeah. Now, Roger, you and I have both seen tons of bodybuilding contests, both amateur and professional, and it was really magical what happened that night, because it's kind of, posing is kind of a unique thing, because it's something that's done silently, right? It's done silently on the stage. The guy's not talking. He's just performing. So it's a connection between the bodybuilder and the audience. And for some reason, whatever happened that night, it was just so magical, because Corney caught that audience's imagination or whatever. And the place just went insane. It went nuts. And of course, it was because of his incredible posing, and he was in great shape. But how often have we ever seen anything like that happen? And I've tried to describe, what it was like, because I was there and I was a novice. I was only 14 years old, and it was one of the first contests I ever saw. But it was just an amazing experience being there and watching Corney do this incredible posing, and the connection he had with the audience and the reaction he had. It was like, I think there was 3 standing ovations that day, right?
Well, I'll tell you one thing to add on to what you're saying. The best physique that night, in my opinion, was Frank Zane, and he deserved to win the Mr. Olympia. But
right.
Ed Corney nearly stole that Olympia. And if he had been declared the winner after that posing routine, I don't think you would have seen any of the rioting that took place in 1980 or 81. And second of all, that what I don't think people realize, that Corney gave the greatest posing performance of his career at 44 years old.
Yeah.
It's not like this was a young guy coming up who startled the world. This
right.
This guy was older than any other competitor in the contest that night.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's something that's sort of forgotten about. And I remember in Pumping Iron, they mentioned that he was in his 40s. But yeah, Ed was born in 1933. So he got into bodybuilding kind of late. And he really was at his peak when he was in his mid-40s. That's just amazing.
Yeah, and the fact that he took, I think, third that night or whatever he did.
Yeah, third. Mm-hmm.
To Zane and to Robbie, a tremendous credit to him. And I think realistically, it was a high point of his career.
Yeah.
And the best, you know, his best placing, even though he had won the universe earlier in the IFB Mr. America, I think that third place Olympian 77 was the culmination of Ed Courtney's great career.
Yeah.
And it's just very sad that, you know, that he got ill and that he succumbed to this aneurysm on January 1st. He's really a great of the game.
All right, in this clip, this was also on the Ed Courtney tribute. I read an article from Muscle Builder magazine, which I believe came out in 1976. One of the best articles I ever read. And Ed was really, really open about what really got him into bodybuilding and what was so inspiring to him about bodybuilding. It was one of the most thoughtful and memorable articles I think I ever read by any bodybuilder. So anyways, I thought it was a great article to read as we went over and looked back in tribute of Ed Courtney's life. And Ed, in this clip here that I read from the article that was in the magazine, Ed talks about going to California in Venice and training with Arnold in 1975 for the Mr. Olympia contest that was featured, of course, in the movie Pumping Iron. And it was a showdown between him and Franco Colombo in the under 200-pound class. So you're really going to like this tribute. Here we go. It says, I had to make up my mind. Was I going to compete in the Mr. Olympia or what? 1975 was already half gone. It was the first time that a major world contest would be held according to weight classes, two of them, divided at the 200-pound mark. I knew for sure who I would have to face in the under 200. One was Franco, the other was Frank Zane, three-time Mr. Universe winner, who fell 1 point short of victory over Franco the year before in New York in 1974. The target was November in South Africa. For days, I contemplated the idea. I couldn't think of anything else. Where would I train? How would I train? What kind of restrictions would I put against myself? I'm the co-owner of a nightclub, Fonzie's, in San Francisco, and it takes up a lot of my time. George Butler of Pumping Iron had called me and asked me if I would come down to Los Angeles to work in this picture. I live in San Francisco. Armed with twin purposes, I told my partners at the club that I was leaving to train for the Mr. Olympia and that I would be gone for 3 months. I told my fiance I was leaving and that I would be gone for 3 months. It was the only way I felt I could get into professional shape. I remember calling Arnold in Santa Monica and asking him if I could come down there and train with him. He had just finished making a movie from the book Stay Hungry, and he was down to 210 pounds body weight. Lean, but not out of shape, he said. Arnold said over the phone he knew that if he wanted to get back to 235 in perfect shape, he would have to do a lot of training, a lot of good eating, be in the right atmosphere and the right frame of mind. He said ever since he had returned, it was July, he had been fooling around training with different guys in search of a suitable training partner, which he had always felt to be a most important part of his training. In the process, he said he had asked himself which of the guys was the most hungry. Kent Keene wasn't hungry. Danny Gable was only half hungry. Ken Waller liked to fool around too much. No one else at the time seemed geared for the effort that he contemplated. He too wanted to train for the Mr. Olympia. He wanted to win it for the sixth time. When I told him how I felt about wanting to win Mr. Olympia, I guess I must have sounded very convincing because Arnold said yes, he'd be glad to start training with me. I told him I wanted to beat everybody, and that's all he needed to hear. He tells me now that I sounded just as hungry as he was. We had trained together for a short period in Germany a few years previously, so he was aware of my nature and my capability. It was summer, and the first day I stepped out on Venice Beach, I heard someone say, "He's fat." I weighed 187. I was fat. If you want to be the best, you train with the best. Our training sessions were unbelievable. Arnold went up in body weight. I went down. In that way, we are opposites. In another way, we are similar. Our arms are our strong points. We have the kind of bodies that can do any pose. He's the big version. I'm the small one. We worked out twice a day using the Weider double split system, 6 days a week. We squatted until we fell on the floor. We used every training trick in our books. In the meantime, we were filming Pumping Iron. After the first few weeks, we decided that I should move into his house with him so we could eat together, get our schedules together, and fine focus our efforts on the big goal. Arnold enjoyed it immensely. We went to the beach together, to parties, to the gym.
It was a joy. It had a lot of meaning. I wish all of life was like that. Arnold couldn't believe the way I was changing from day to day. Abdominals, intercostals. I got up to 2,500 sit-ups, twists and crunches every day. I got into the gym in the morning an hour before him so I could work on my abdominals. He was doing 500 reps himself every day. We dieted. No cookies, no cakes. We both loved that stuff. Arnold was so strict, he went down in body weight, finally competing at 225 instead of the expected 235. The 2 months that we trained together both put us in the best shape of our lives. Arnold's description of my appearance at the South Africa Mr. Universe show stands on a pedestal in my mind like the ultimate trophy. We looked up at you there and we couldn't believe our eyes. It was a beautiful finished piece of art. 10 of us bodybuilders from all over the world were sitting there in the first row watching your posing during the prejudging. You went through your routine without a mistake for 3 minutes like a flowing Michelangelo statue. No one could find a word of criticism, a rare condition for such a sophisticated lot. We were enchanted. I felt like I had a hand in it. I was emotionally involved. Call me Dr. Frankenstein or something. You had defined a part of bodybuilding up there that none of us were able to do. Arnold said that, and I'll always thrill at the thought of his words. I feel terribly lucky. Of course, he had his other favorite there, Franco. He had always been involved in Franco's efforts in the same emotional way. Now he saw the both of us, Franco and I, competing together for the lightweight bodybuilding prize, and that fascinated him. Mix that in with his emotional involvement for both of us, and you get the drama and intrigue Arnold loves. All right, in this clip, Pat Neve was our guest on the show, and Pat was the 1974 AAU Mr. USA overall winner. And in one part of our interview, Pat talked about meeting Arnold in person at Gold's Gym in 1973, as Arnold was only about 2 weeks away from competing in the Mr. Olympia that year. Pat was friends with Jim Morris, and Jim was, I believe, the 1973 AAU Mr. America winner. He trained at Bill Pearl's gym. So Pat became friends with Jim, and Jim asked Pat, "Do you want to meet Arnold?" So Pat and Jim and Pat's wife, Vicky, all drove down to Gold's Gym on a weekday afternoon or a weekend afternoon, and they got to meet Arnold Schwarzenegger. So this is Pat's story.
Call him up, and we said, "We're coming on." He picks us up and takes us to meet Arnold 2 weeks before the
'83
Mr. Olympia.
Really? What was that like?
Oh, my gosh. It's something I'll never forget because, like I said, it's 2 weeks before the Olympia, and so Jim, I like to, you know, meet Arnold, and we're driving in the car. Jim's driving. I'm in the passenger seat, and Vicky's in the back, and Jim looks at me, and he says, "Okay, Pat, I'll take you to meet Arnold, but I just want you to know one of two things are going to happen." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You're going to see him, and you're going to say, 'I can never look like this, and I'm going to quit,' or you're going to say, 'I'm going to do everything I can and try to look as close to this.'" He said, "But just remember, there's only one of him." Now, I've never seen nothing like that, so how do you know how to compare? It's just like when I first bought my Ferraris. No one knows what a Ferrari drives like unless you drive one. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I never seen a Schwarzenegger, and I at that time I hadn't drove a Ferrari, so I don't know.
Right.
Mr. America's, I mean, I'm close to these guys at that time. What could this guy look like? So we walk into Gold's Gym, and we walk in, and we see Zane and Ken Waller and Dave Draper. And over in the corner, it's Arnold, 2 weeks before the Olympia, 73, in a tank top, shorts, no shoes, doing curls across the gym. And I look, I'm standing, Vicky sits down. And I'm standing, I'm looking over there at him, and I'm thinking, "Oh, he's not as tall as I thought he would be." And then Jim Morris goes over to him, and he must say something, you know, "Pat Neve is here to see you." And Arnold say something like, you know, in one minute. And so he puts the bar down, and he comes walking towards me. And as he's walking towards me, he's getting bigger, wider, whip, cut, phenomenal. I'm getting smaller and smaller. Want to shrivel up and die. He comes over. He reaches out to shake my hand. I can hardly, I don't want him to see my arm. I don't even want to touch his hand. I shake his hand. I shake hand. And he says, I finished up, but that's when he had a real, real thick accent. I finished up, I talk to you, Pot. We go get lunch. And so he goes and does a few more things. He turns around, walks away. I point to his calves. I look at Vicky. I said, look, look. And the giant calves, which like grapefruits, he's walking away. And this Jim Morris said, man, I collapse on this bench. I collapse on this bench, and I look at Vicky, and I say, I can never look like that.
Wow.
You know how they say behind every man is a good woman? Well, she turned to me, John, and she said, that's exactly what you look like, but a smaller version. She said,
wow.
Big chest, those fantastic arms and delts. She said, that's exactly what you look like in a tank top, except smaller. And
wow,
she said, all
awesome.
You do is be the best short man you could be. And at that moment, that's what I tried to be. I never thought I'd be swatching it. I just thought, man, I just push myself to be as good as I can, you know. And so that's how I met him. We went out to dinner. Then he's the first person to call me up when I won Mr. USA. The first person.
Wow.
Yeah, and we're at dinner, my wife and I and the kids, the phone rings. I pick it up. I say, hello. And the voice goes, hello, Bot. This is Arno. And I said, who? He says, Arno. And I said, again, I can't understand him. I said, the third time, I said, who? He goes, Arno Schwarzenegger, man, you deaf. Oh, my heart's pumping a million miles an hour. I can't believe Arnold Schwarzenegger is calling me, and he says, congratulations, you know, in his thick accent. Congratulations, I'm proud of you, you know. How would you like to guest pose with my Mr. California? So I just won the night before. I don't know nothing about how much they charge. I don't know nothing. And so he says, how would you like to guest pose on my show? I pay you away. I take your expenses. How much you want? I'm too scared to say. I don't even know what to say. You know, in my mind, at the time, I'm thinking, you know, $1,000, but it's Arno, man. I don't know what to say. So I say, well, I'll come for 500. And this is his exact words. He says, 500? Hey, man, you better get a manager because you need to get 750 to 1,000. I said, how about 750? He says, okay. And so he brought me to California, and then got a good reception there, and he we set up a few seminars together, he and I. And
no kidding.
Yeah, I mean, from there, he and I became real close, worked out many, many times together, did TV, did many shows, guest posed together, did lots of stuff. I wish we had cell phones, have pictures of all us, but we did it.
That's amazing.
All
right. One of my favorite guests on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is Boyer Coe. Boyer, of course, was one of the greatest bodybuilders in the 1970s. He won the Mr. America in 1969. He also won the Universe that year. And then he had one of the greatest pro careers ever, competing in the IFBB in the late 70s and then on to the 1980s. So Boyer is a great interview. He has a great memory. He remembers all these great stories, and he's a great storyteller, as you'll see in these clips. So we did an interview with Boyer about the NABBA Mr. Universe contest that he competed in, or his memories of competing in the NABBA Universe. I think Boyer won 4 NABBA Mr. Universe contests. He was doing that show a lot before he went over to the IFBB. So in this first clip, Boyer talks about training as a teenager and bench pressing 400 pounds while he was still in high school, and then some of the earlier contests he competed in when he was living in Louisiana.
How did the people in high school, your other students, how did they take to you being a bodybuilder? Because I know I started bodybuilding in the late 70s, and everybody thought it was the weirdest thing ever.
Oh, I was a complete oddity. They didn't know what to do with me. But the interesting thing about it in going through high school, and I went through high school with a bunch of really badass kids. Everybody thought I was badass because I was so much stronger than everybody else. It wasn't that I was tough or anything. But I got a certain amount of respect just because I was so much stronger than everybody else. So they automatically assumed, wow, if this guy is strong, he must be one bad son of a bitch. And I really wasn't, but nobody messed with me.
And you bench pressed 400 pounds when you were still in high school, right?
Oh, yeah, I did. That was my goal. That's one of the things I wanted to do. I don't know why bench press was so important, but that was one of the things I loved to do. So I made up my mind, I guess when I was about 14, I said, I got to do 400 pounds, basically because way back in those days, there wasn't a whole lot of people really that strong in, you know, or at least I didn't know about it in the sport. So I figured, well, if I could do that 400 pounds, by the time I got out of high school, that would be a good accomplishment. Much of my stuff was always done by me writing down and setting a goal or a time limit. I had to do this by such and such a time. And then I would sit it and then go about trying to accomplish that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I remember you said you would write that down all the time, 400.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, I got in a lot of trouble in high school from doing it because I carved 400 in my desk. I mean, it was just covered with 400, and they raised so much hell they had to put another desk in the room. I got a lot of trouble for that.
What was the contest you went in? I think it was in Texas where you went out the wrong door when you were getting ready for the show.
Oh, no. That happened in going back to that Mr. Louisiana contest that it was held in January. The interesting thing about that, see, once again, I didn't know who, I had no experience.
Yeah.
So I'm in the pump-up room, and I'm watching these other guys copying what they were doing to try to keep from looking like a fool. So we're in the pump-up room, and I'm pumping up, getting ready for the show. All of a sudden, I realize I'm the only one left in the pump-up room. Everybody else was getting ready to line up to go on stage.
Mm-hmm.
So I missed out. So I must be late. So I run out the wrong door. It was held at the YMCA. Mm-hmm. The door slams shut. Okay, so now I'm standing in the alley and nothing but my pulling trunks and baby oil on. And it's cold as hell. It's in January.
Right.
And I'm beating on the door, but no one's in the pump-up room. I can't get back in. So I have to run all the way a block, all the way around the YMCA and come in through the front door to where the crowd is at.
Right.
I mean, my heart was, I thought it was going to beat through my chest. Okay? So I get right through the front door as they're calling my name. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I make my way, I get up on the stage, you know, and I mean, of course, nobody looking at my feet, but my feet were all dirty from running right around the block. So
you had to run through the audience to get back up on the stage.
Well, yeah, but I had to run around a block down the alley and around the front door to get in barefoot,
right,
you know?
Right, right.
So my dad was with me. So after the contest was over, we're driving home the next day. You're just daydreaming, driving back. He says, you know, he said, that was pretty cool. He says, how you came in through the entrance. He said, that surprised a lot of people. I didn't have a heart to tell him that I'd gotten locked out. You know, that's why I had to do it. So he never knew that I was just such a fool that I had to run all the way around the alley to get in the front door to compete in the contest.
That's a classic story. All right, in this clip with Boyer talks about meeting the great Sergio Oliva back in 1966 when they both competed in the AAU Junior Mr. America. And then you went into the Junior Mr. America in 66, and that was the one that Sergio was in, right? That's where you first met Sergio?
Oh, God, yeah. That to me was another outstanding moment. I had saw a couple of photographs of Sergio in Iron Man, and he looked unbelievable. But he was a guy that even, and I know you've seen him in person, he was a guy that your mind just couldn't comprehend when you saw him, that he was real. He just looked like a caricature. And I've read in the past where people say, you know, he was belligerent, he wasn't nice. But I always felt Sergio to be an extremely nice guy. You know, I got along with him really well. But he was unbelievable. And not only was he such a unique physique, but the way he dressed made him really stand out. You noticed that Sergio Oliva was in the room when you were around him. He was a great guy, you know. I'm sorry that in his later years, and I regret that I didn't have a chance to visit with him before he passed away, because I had a lot of respect for him. And I recall when he passed away, there was no one, or they didn't have enough funds to put to, for his headstone.
Wow.
So I said, and I can't remember who was the guy that was kind of like his manager or something. So I contacted the guy. I said, well, look, I would certainly like to pay for Sergio's headstone. I mean, he was such a great bodybuilder, one of the greatest, and a great influence on me. And I said, well, who do I send the money to? Mm-hmm. So he writes back. He said, well, you can't send it to, and I don't remember what her name is, his ex-wife, he says, because I can't guarantee you that that'll happen. So I kept trying to call around, and as a result, unfortunately, it never got done. So to this day, I don't know if he has a headstone on his grave or not.
Wow. Yeah, I know my friend from Chicago, Dennis, he went to the funeral, and he said there weren't too many people there. So that was kind of a shame for someone who was such a mythic figure in the bodybuilding world and such a great bodybuilder.
He was tremendous. I wish I would have been able to. But I didn't actually even find out about the funeral or the memorial till it was already over with.
Yeah.
And I think maybe if people would have known in advance, you know, more people would have been able to attend it.
Yeah. And didn't you say at that contest that you guys actually taped his waist and his thighs, and his thigh was bigger than his waist?
Oh, yeah. It's funny. At that time, as unbelievable as he was, he did not weigh that much. He only weighed about 198 pounds. He wasn't even over 200 pounds. At that time, he and I were probably pretty close to the same body weight. But I remember, once again, because we had to wait through all the weightlifting, we were back there goofing around in the gym. That's how he and I got to be friends. Because one of the things that I was always exceptionally good at, and I don't know why, was climbing a rope. Hmm. Okay? So they had a big rope up at the top of the rafters in the gym. So we're goofing around, and he tried to climb the rope, and he couldn't get all the way to the top. So I tried it, and I could easily get it all the way to the top. So he was impressed. I was only, I think I might have been 18 or 19 at the time.
Uh-huh.
So he was impressed that this kid could do that, you know. But I remember that people couldn't get over how small his waist was.
Right.
They measured his waist, and it was 27 inches. Because I was standing there. 27 inches. So then they measured each one of his thighs. Each one of his thighs was 29. And, of course, later on, he got much bigger than that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But he just was unbelievable.
I mean, all these years later, that was 50 years ago. And I just posted a picture of him, I think from 1981, on my Facebook page yesterday. And all these people were commenting, you know, he's the best ever. He's the best ever. It's just amazing that all these years have gone by and all these guys are so big now. But you look at Sergio, and he really was something special. One of the most unique bodybuilders ever.
I tell you, John, there is a photograph taken that I did everything in the world to get a copy of. It was taken at the 1972 Mr. Olympia in Essen, Germany. And it took me a long time to find out who took the photograph, and it was taken by Albert Busek. Mm-hmm. And it was Sergio's one-of-a-kind, you know, victory pose.
Yeah.
That was single greatest bodybuilding photograph, in my opinion, that was ever taken.
I agree with you.
There's several versions of it, but that one picture at the 72 Olympia outshines everything anybody has ever done. I don't care how big and how good you are. That photograph is so dramatic, it just stands alone.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, and finally, we've got one more clip from our interview with Boyer, because he's such a great storyteller. I had to include three different clips from him. In this one, Boyer talks about going over to London for the first time and competing in the NABBA Mr. Universe, which was 1969. Now, Boyer had just won the Mr. America contest, and he was going up against Jim Haislop, who always used to beat Boyer when they competed in the AAU, and also Franco Colombo, who won the short class. And then Boyer ended up winning the overall title at the NABBA Mr. Universe in his very first time competing it.
Then we go next year. I'm fortunate enough to win in 69, okay? But what took place in 69 was far more important than the contest itself, because what happened the day before I had to leave to go, I'm working out with a guy in the gym, and he puts some rosin on his hands, you know, to get a better grip. Well, he's spotting me. I'm on the bench press. Some of the stuff comes off his hands and falls into my eye. Okay, so it starts bothering my eye, and I don't really take care of it. I'm trying to get ready to go to contest. So by the time I get to New York, I'm telling Dennis, I said, you know, I said, my eye's really bothering me. I still don't do nothing about it.
Right.
So we catch an overnight flight. We leave New York, and we land in London, I guess, about 6:30 in the morning. By the time I get to the hotel, I can't see out of my eye anymore. Thinking, my God, it's swollen up.
Wow.
So I check into the hotel. I said, I got to do something. So I get a cab, and I told the cab driver, I said, look, can you take me to the nearest hospital? So we dropped me off, and luckily I found a doctor. He cleans my eye out, and yeah, I can see again. It feels good. But he says, okay, you got to wear this patch over your eye for 24. I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't want to look like a pirate. So he puts his patch on my eye, so then I got to go back to the hotel. By that time, all the other competitors are there. So here's a guy who's the current Mr. America, and they think, hell, he's only got one eye, you know? So I said, oh, man. So then I became friends with some of the guys from England, like Frank Richards was a great guy.
Yeah,
Frank, great bodybuilder. Those guys were extremely friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So we go out this night, and the night before the contest, I said, well, look, let's go over to Wag Bennett's house. He's a party over there.
Mm-hmm.
So killing time, I go. So I keep running into things because I can't see good. I only got one eye. So I said, this is embarrassing. So I finally, I guess about midnight, took the eye patch off and threw it away, and then I could see all right. You know?
And it ended up working good because you won the contest. You won your class, and you won the overall in your first Nava Universe.
That one, yeah. And the funny thing about that contest was after the contest was over with, okay, so what you do, you go from the old Royal Hotel, which was really run-down hotel, but, hell, you didn't care, you know. You go from the coach would pick you up, bring you to the contest, and then bring you back to the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all I had on was my warm-up suit and my posing trunks and my little workout bag. So I didn't think to take any money with me. So the contest is over with, and I won, and I'm thrilled to death that I won. This is a great accomplishment. And I finally beat Jim Haslam. After him beating me for 2 years, you know?
Right, he won the tall class, and you won the medium class.
Yeah, so, and then Franco won the short class.
Right.
So, the guy told us, you know, after the contest is over, you go out of the stage door and the bus will be parked, you know, a block down.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking my time. I'm going out, and there's an old gentleman there. I guess it was kind of the manager. So I said, I noticed when I went outside, I had all the streets blocked off. So I said, well, what's going on? I said, well, what's happened here? The guy says, oh, I says, everybody's waiting to see the new Mr. Universe winner. I said, you mean people are waiting to see people? I said, yeah. I said, man, they all raised and held him and shake my hands. So I was overjoyed. I got so involved in that, the bus took off and left me, okay? And I didn't have any money, so I couldn't catch a cab.
Right.
So I had to walk all the way back from where the Prince Albert Hall, I think was, back to the hotel. And I've always had a pretty good sense of direction, so I kind of figured out where the hotel was at. But it wouldn't have mattered. I could have walked back barefoot. It didn't make any difference to me.
You're so happy.
Because I was so happy. So later that night, we all go out. We're going to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
So Frank Richard and a bunch of his buddies from England were in this bar. So Frank and I get up to go to the bar to order drinks for, there must have been 7 or 8 guys. So we're standing at the bar talking, and right next to Frank and I, but on Frank's side of the bar, were 2 lesbians, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, they get in this hellacious fight. They're fighting and throwing drinks everywhere, and they throw they throw a drink all over Frank's suit, and he's pissed. So he immediately grabs one of them. Well, when he grabs one, okay, the second one turns on Frank, and she jumps on Frank's back, and she's clawing him all up. So I grab her and pull him off of him.
Right.
And as I spin around, I see the strangest thing I have ever seen in my life until this day. I don't know if you've ever seen people who have, and I'm trying to think of the correct name. They call it a werewolf syndrome. It's called hypotrichosis. In other words, it's people where they grow hair for whatever reason all over the body. Their face and everything is covered. Everything. Mm-hmm. It looks like a werewolf. Okay, when I spin around and pull this girl off of Frank's back, this guy's standing right in front of me. Scares the living shit out of me. I'm thinking, my God, what the hell is going on? I thought it was a werewolf, you know?
It was Lon Chaney.
Well, this guy was the bouncer in the place.
Really?
He grabbed those two lesbians. He just smashes their heads together and drags them out of the place. So now he wasn't able to talk. He couldn't talk.
Really? Wow.
And he comes back in, and he made us made Frank and I understand. He wanted to thank us for breaking the thing up because they were just breaking glass. I told Frank, I said, you know, I think it's time for us to get the hell out of here. But that, and you know, it's funny. After I saw that, I thought about it for a long time. There's only 50 or so people in the world that have that rare condition.
Really? Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's very, very unusual. And this happened to be one of them.
He was right there.
Oh, wow. God. I'm telling you, that was, like I said, the events leading up to and after the contest were much more eventful than the contest itself.
All right, our next clip comes from Season 7, Episode 41. This was an interview we did with Jeff King, who was the 1983 Mr. America winner. Jeff is still to this day one of the most popular and considered one of the best Mr. America winners ever. Jeff had leg development that was on par with Tom Platz, and he had crazy upper development, especially his neck. He had like a 22-inch neck. So in this part of the interview with Jeff, Jeff talks about the training that he used to develop his physique. He didn't go as heavy as his physique looks like it did, but Jeff talks about different types of training and what worked for him.
Yeah, well, he was... Yeah, Mike Mentzer, you know, I love that guy's build. Yeah, he was incredible. But he was like, he did the, you know, the Nautilus thing, like, fourth failure. I remember reading it and you know, coming from the Arnold and the high volume.
Yeah.
You know, it was hard for me to swallow. I tried it a couple times, but I just didn't feel it the same. And, you know, obviously it worked. And, you know, I think Dorian Yates was sort of did the same thing.
Yeah.
And scientifically, it made sense because you only need to stimulate the muscles so that if you hit a cap, just a certain hardness, and it explodes, that's all you need to do with muscles. You just need to stimulate it. But once you go beyond that, you start killing your recovery energy. So, you know, it made a lot of sense, but I just, you know, I always stuck between, I don't know, 9 to 12 sets per muscle group, except in the off season when I was doing a lot of heavy deadlifts, heavy squats, you know, I cut down on the volume and just, you know, I just really upped the intensity.
Were you pretty strong as a teenager, Jeff, when you started?
No, you know what's funny? I was never a super, my brother was a super strong kid, man. I mean, that kid was so strong. He's a natural athlete and, you know, he competed and, he did powerlifting for a while, but he did the bodybuilding for a while. But I was never a super strong kid, but I always had, you know, volume. You know, like I just my muscles just would grow, and I wouldn't be super strong, but I would do higher reps, and I could, you know, like I would deadlift, I would pull because I had a bad back. I couldn't do a couple heavy lifts, but I could pull 405 20 times. So, you know, I could just keep, you know, I had good endurance, but then once I started, you know, the heaviest bench I ever did, I did a 500 bench at once in my life. I only front squatted. So I think most I ever did was probably 375 for set to 8, but I never really trained for singles, you know, because I just knew I might get hurt. But I was never a super strong guy, you know, I never was.
How did you hurt your back?
But I could go. I could go. Like, I could just go. Like, I used to love training with guys and puking them, you know? You know, because I would just keep going. I wouldn't stop. I'd pick that weight and go. You're set. And, you know, sooner or later, you know, either I die or they die, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I remember, I'm friends with Chris Aceto still. And he said, he said, he remembered training legs with you. And he said he would get so nervous he'd almost throw up before the workout, before going in to train legs with you.
He went to Springfield College. He was a good guy, man. He was another like science trainer, you know. He really thought about what he was doing and what was the physiology and, you know, just trying to, you know, understand that what you're doing doesn't make sense, you know. So for me, that's how my brain works. So, you know, that's what worked for me when it came to training. I loved playing with stuff, trying different stuff, and then, you know, I saw what worked for me.
Mm-hmm. When you saw Mike Antorino, when you competed against him in that first show, did you say, this is what I want to do, I want to be a bodybuilder? Did that really get your fire going when you competed in that first show?
Yeah, he was a scary-looking guy. I remember he had on these glasses. He had on these, like, shaded glasses, and he had a snake. I think he saw a tattoo on his back. And
really?
No, he was so thick, and he had huge traps. You know, I got there. I just, you know what? If I left there with a trophy, that I couldn't even believe. I didn't care if I got fifth and there was five trophies. If I left with a trophy, that was
right.
It.
Right.
Yeah, but actually, that's where I met Bob Gruskin, and you know, I never thought I had any. I didn't think I had any potential. I was just doing it because it was there, and I was doing all the weight, you know, the training. And Bob Gruskin said, you got great lines. He goes, you know, you could do good at this. You know, where do you train? Hmm. You know, and that really made me think, like, really? Like, you think? And, you know, and then he hooked me up with – I remember trained with Mike Antorino a couple times and just Danny Morrow. I don't know if you remember him. He was in the Teen USA. Danny had a great physique as a young guy. And so, you know, I just – you know, you just sort of find out what other guys are doing. And, you know, a lot of the guys were, you know, they train hard, you know. And they, again, a lot of overtraining, you know, just lots of sets. And
right.
John Defendis, I don't know if you remember John Defendis.
Oh, yeah. I talked to John on the show,
Bob Gruskin, because he was working with John, he put me with John. And but at the time, John was training at Mihalik's gym in New York, and you know, Steve Mihalik had the intensity insanity thing, and those guys were insane. You know, they were doing like 70 sets, 40 sets of body part, and that wasn't for me, but
all right. And then another clip here from the Jeff King interview. Jeff talks about getting ready for that Mr. America contest that he won, which is his most famous contest ever. And Jeff talks about the training and the nutrition program that he followed in order to compete and win that Mr. America contest. So tell me about your prep going into that America. You had to know you were looking awesome because you looked in incredible shape that year.
Well, you know, I knew, like I said, I didn't have any plans to go into America. I didn't decide to go into America until 3 weeks before.
Okay.
I was training for the Eastern America, and I was going to, it was during the summer. I was training for that show through the summer because I think it was like in August or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing the hydrostatic weighing and enjoying my training. I mean, I do remember like sitting down, and I remember thinking, I'm not going to be able to get out of this chair. You know, like, I really did. You know, I'd have to. And at the time, Rick Sampson, I was training with Rick Sampson, and Rick was, that guy trained hard, man. He was a great training partner. And he trained hard. He knew how to diet. He was a very obsessive guy. And we trained great together. And, you know, I remember both of us going to the gym, and I just think, how am I going to get through a workout? And then once I got the blood going, it's like I came alive. So training was fun. It was, you know, I always, the best part for me, it's like Christmas, you know, it's the wait. Once the day comes, it's over in an instant. So it was always that training. I loved the training. I loved the feeling of I might not get this. And then that was like, oh, you're going to get it, you know. So it sort of was like that power of the mind and just knowing that. I always used to say sometimes seminars, like when I would diet, I actually had get to a point where I feel like if I wanted to starve myself, I could. Like mm-hmm. I felt like I really had that that mindset to say I can do whatever I put my mind to. So
yeah,
you know, yeah, it's sort of like you know, maybe like anorexia. You know, it's like mm-hmm. I'm not gonna right. eat, you don't eat, but
right.
you know, of course I was starving. I couldn't wait to eat, but I did feel like I loved that feeling of you know, like I can suck it up, like being in the battle. You know, I got to do what mm-hmm. I got to do.
Yeah, the challenge, yeah. What did you weigh for that show, Jeff, The America?
Yeah, I weighed 222.
Wow, okay.
And you know what? I still have all my, like, all my weighings I did, you know, all my high mm-hmm. weighings, what my lean uh-huh. was, what my fat. I remember I was at 3.1% underwater weighing, like, three weeks before that America.
Damn, that's low.
That's the lowest I ever got, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So did you feel like you had a good shot going in it? I mean, you had to feel really confident seeing the way you looked.
I the mirror never did me any justice. Like, I never thought I knew I was in the best shape of my life, but mm-hmm. I didn't have any clue until I got there, because I knew some good guys were coming. You know, I knew mm-hmm. like Marty Brannicar was going to be there, and Larry,
yeah.
and Jesse Goutreau. There are a couple guys. Rick Poston, I think, was in there. And
yep.
so,
yep.
I just went with, this is my last show, and I'm going to chiropractic, so I'm going to do the best I could. But once I was in the back and warming up, I realized I was in the best condition of my life. And I said, well, you know, I really didn't, you know, until people, I started hearing, like, in the audience, people going, King, you know, and I just, you know, I started to think, like, wow, I could do pretty good here, you know. And so
mm-hmm.
I never went into a show thinking, oh, I'm going to win this. You know, I never cared what judges thought, because, mm-hmm. you know, that's the problem with bodybuilding. It's not a problem. It's a reality body. It's subjective. And you look at the history. Look at the change from the Frank Zanes to the Bertil Foxes to the, you know, the body types based on, you know, a trend that was going in the sport. So
yeah,
to me,
yeah.
I just cared that I was, again, that art part of me and that science thing. I just cared that I was looking the way I wanted to look, and that for me it was the best. Like, I loved, like, Bertil Fox. There's another one. When I saw mm-hmm. him, I said, that guy was thicker than a brick. I mean, that was the kind of build I liked. Frank Zane, you know, I know he did well and all, but that wasn't, I don't care if that was a trend, I'd never go there. I'd lose every time then, because I'd love to fight Bertil Fox, you know?
Yeah, right, right.
You know, or the Lee Haneys, or, you know, just the guys with just incredible mass. And that's what impressed me, you know?
Right.
Tom Platz was an, you know, he was an idol, you know.
I
remember him when he was in muscular development, and his upper body was still a little behind, but his legs were like, Jesus Christ.
Oh, right.
My God. A freak. And that was it, the freak factor. That, for me, that's what bodybuilding, hey, who cares when? It's an opinion. I like that freak factor. You know, that's why I trained, you know.
Yeah. So what were your leg workouts like back then, Jeff? Because you had these legendary legs. So I got to ask you, what were your workouts like?
Yeah, I know what they are. I wish I could still do them now. front squats. I still would train the same, John, but I got a bad hip. I need a total hip.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's just tough. You know, it's not fun anymore. I still work out, still try to train hard, but arthritis, you know, like a lot of these guys who trained heavy when they were younger,
yeah,
you know, they're reaping the benefits now.
Mm-hmm.
But I did front squats, then I did what I called duck presses. It was on a lying down, you know, vertical leg press. But
vertical leg press, yeah. Uh-huh.
And then I did hack squats, and then I did knee extensions, and that was it. And if I wasn't getting ready for a show, I just did those three. I did the front,
okay.
the presses and the hacks. And I loved hack squats. I loved it. That was such a great exercise.
Yeah. And what was the weight like, Jeff? How much were your front squat?
Front squatting, early on, I might have been front squatting with 275, 265. I'd do like 3 sets of 10. But then as I was getting bigger, as I was getting in my mid-20s, late 20s, like I said, I was fronting 365.
Okay.
And I used to think that was great. And there was this guy, Nicky Carolla. Do you remember Zach Nathan from Zach's Gym in Connecticut?
No, I don't remember that name.
If you look him up, he had a bunch of good guys come out of his gym. And Zach was very involved with the IFBB. But this guy, Nicky Carolla, I remember him front squatting like 500. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And back then, that was, now guys front squat. Who's the guy, 8-time Mr. Olympia? I'm drawing a blank for some reason.
Roddy Coleman.
Yeah.
Right.
Now that guy, to me, was the ultimate bodybuilder. I mean, he trained like, I've never seen anyone as strong as him. And bodybuilding movements. And then there's another example of a body being riddled from the load of years of load. And I saw that documentary, but I'm going to tell you what, that guy, he's like a worker, man. Like, he's like, to me, the ultimate bodybuilder. It was about training and pushing. Mm-hmm. And then the guy works still, he'd get ready for his job. He's still in his cop uniform. I mean, the guy just was so grounded, and anything he did, whether it was business, school, he excelled in everything.
What a
great example of an athlete for me,
Right. All right, and then finally we're going to finish off with a clip from our interview with Ken Sprague. And Ken, of course, was the owner of Gold's Gym during the 1970s. Ken was really instrumental for promoting Gold's Gym to the general public, and he was really also very instrumental in getting bodybuilding out to the general public. Everybody, of course, credits Arnold for that, but Ken was really, really a big part of that. So in this clip of the interview here, Ken first talks about buying Gold's Gym and then what he did to market the gym out to the general public. He was a really good businessman and an excellent marketer. And then in the second part of our clip, Ken talks about working with director George Butler about the filming of Pumping Iron and how he was able to use that to Gold's Gym's advantage.
Gosh, I'll buy the gym. And he was an antique dealer. And he got into problems financially. He had a big load of antiques on the boat or waiting at the dock, and he didn't have the money. And he needed – now, this is going to knock your socks off. But all it cost me to go in to buy the gym, the business, the building next door, and the lot next door to that, a block away from the ocean outside of Los Angeles, all I had to put up was $15,000 down.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah, exactly. It is unbelievable. But at that time, at that time, Gold's is such a famous place, and it became a famous place after I bought it in the 70s. But it had not been mentioned in one national publication other than an occasional mention in Weider's magazine, and I think once or twice in the other magazines.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as mainstream media, like newspapers and TV spots, it was totally unknown. Not one spot in all that time.
And bodybuilding was pretty much unknown at that time, too, also.
Oh, yeah. It was tough rounding up enough to have a contest. My first contest promotion, I did it. I felt I had to do it. Incidentally, Ken Waller gets a lot of credit because I wouldn't have bought the gym had it not been for Waller agreeing to manage it for me. We had known one another back in Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah. And, okay.
Yeah. In fact, I judged him. I was a judge for the Mr. Midwest contest, which he won in the late 70s. Or, I'm sorry, late 60s.
Okay.
And we got to know one another. He was from Kentucky at that time. And I said, Ken, you manage your gym and I'll buy it. Again, figuring I wouldn't lose too much money on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Ken agreed, and he was a manager for a couple of years, and that was that. But I think I was about to talk about that first contest promotion.
Yeah.
I thought just because the guys, needed contests, that I'd hold the Mr. Western America contest, IFBB Mr. Western America. I had no idea about the political organizations. I said, I asked Joe. I said, Joe Weider. I said, how about if I go ahead and put on the Mr. Western America? Well, I did. I put it at a famous comedy club on Sunset Strip, Zero's. And I had a tough time drumming up, I think there were six competitors. And this is going to give you a sense. You mentioned bodybuilding at the time. It wasn't that big a deal. I paid Arnold Schwarzenegger, of course. I paid Arnold and I paid Ken Waller as guest posers for this event. We only drew maybe 50 spectators. Of course, that was, that was a novice promoter at that time. We drew maybe 50 spectators, but Arnold and Waller, out of the goodness of my heart, I gave them $50 each to guest pose.
Wow.
So time did. They changed.
And it's interesting too, because you said you didn't know anything about the different organizations and stuff, because the AAU was the big amateur competition back then. That was the only, I started competing in
and
the 70s.
And that was, you see, with Weider, he was at the gym frequently, and we were called an IFBB gym at that time. In fact, the AAU didn't want me to ever promote an AAU contest because of association with Gold's Gym. They referred to it as that really wasn't the reason. They wanted to hold on to the contest for themselves, the local AAU group, because the bodybuilding shows, for example, like Mr. Los Angeles and Mr. California, and occasionally a Mr. America show would be sponsored by the Southern California group of weightlifters. They wanted the revenue from the bodybuilding shows to support weightlifting. So they would say, oh, that Gold's Gym, that's an IFBB gym, a professional gym, whatever that means. And they tried to block me from holding contests.
If you're going back to 72, I mean, that's before the MPC started. So there was just AAU and then the IFBB, right? And they were totally separate entities.
Oh, yeah. There wasn't any real IFBB shows. There were in New York. And occasionally there would be one, like there hadn't been one. Frank Zane had done the Mr. Western America also a few years earlier. But there really weren't any IFBB-affiliated contests out on the West Coast or anywhere across the country, except in New York.
And
it was all sort of an illusion for Joe.
Right. So when you bought the gym, Ken, how did you start to turn it around as far as getting more people in there back in 1972?
Well, I had contacts in the motion picture industry.
Okay.
And I thought that, if a producer wants to do a shot in a gym, I'd say, hey, come on down to the gym. All you have to do, your people, if they're doing a gym scene, is wear a Gold's Gym t-shirt. And that got me more publicity than I could have ever afforded to purchase.
Yeah.
There are different movies, different TV shows, and then the shirts would wind up. Roseanne Barr even wore one at the Super Bowl. The Hawk would wear them on his trips around the world. And, of course, seeing them in a film like Pumping Iron, too. Those were all printed for Pumping Iron.
Oh, okay.
But it just established that name worldwide beyond this little storefront gym in Venice, California. There's an interesting story, too, about that T-shirt. Waller said, hey, let's have half a dozen T-shirts made. And I thought, gosh, nobody's going to want a Gold's Gym T-shirt. But I said, okay, go ahead and do it. So he got Rick Drayson to do a little sketch. Waller designed the T-shirt. He said, go ahead and make the man look like the man, the ball-headed guy on the Mr. Clean detergent bottle.
Right.
And just have a bent bar, holding a bent bar. So Drayson went ahead and sketched it out. And that shirt went on before too long to be the top-selling brand shirt in the country.
It was Waller's idea what to put on the shirt, huh?
Exactly. It was all Waller's idea. And me, if it were me, again, I bought the gym primarily for a hobby.
Yeah.
And I never had any thoughts about making any money out of it when I bought it. And I thought, gosh, let's just make it a place to train. And Waller said, oh, we make some money off of a few shirts. No one ever anticipated where Golds would go. Let me put it like this. I never anticipated how big it could be. Mm-hmm. But then I started promoting other shows, and I saw how easy it was to get news media in the gym and at the shows. For example, you mentioned the 77 Mr. America contest.
Mm-hmm.
That contest had more press requests than that year's Academy Awards.
Wow.
And we made it on 60 Minutes, the cover of the Wall Street Journal. I think there were, well, Mae West handed out the trophy. Some of your younger listeners might not know that name. But
yeah, at the time, she was a screen icon, yeah.
Oh, yeah, she was an icon, and she had not made an announced public appearance in a number of years. She was just getting old.
Yeah.
And I managed to talk her into making a public appearance. So that brought out all the old Hollywood types, which made it even a bigger promotion.
Wow. And,
one thing led to another. But Golds was essentially at that time a promotional organization.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the T-shirt. I was just watching the documentary about Studio 54 on Netflix the other day. And they were showing all these old pictures, from when the disco was going on back in the 70s. And one of the girls in there had a Gold's Gym T-shirt on. So it was pretty funny. It shows you that thing was getting around,
Oh, it was getting around. Yeah, it was getting around.
So tell me how George Butler and Charles Gaines approached you about making the movie Pumping Iron in 1975.
Okay, well, before that, of course, they came in for the book.
Okay.
And anybody that wanted to come in there and take a shot, meaning photograph, or write a piece in the paper or write a book, it was open season. I had no restrictions whatsoever. Just come on in and go ahead and do it. Happy to have you. So Pumping Iron, the book, came out. And then, of course, Butler came back with the movie. And again, this is worth putting into context. I had a experience in the motion picture industry. I knew what a producer and a photographer, a director needed to get the best possible product on film. And I told Butler, hey, why don't you go ahead and just string your lights? Golds had high ceilings, 16-foot ceilings. I said, just go ahead and mount your lights permanently. And when you come in to film, just flip them on, and you're all set. Now, he had planned to film at Vince's and Pearl's, but once he got the idea how easy it was going to be for him to film at Gold's, that made Gold's the primary location. So there's all these little nuances to make it happen.
Yeah.
And again, free. Sure, George, go ahead and do it. I knew there was publicity on the other end for Gold's. And I'll be candid with you. I never felt Pumping Iron would be any kind of movie. But I thought, no, the public will never buy this. But there again, you can be wrong and things come out okay.
Yeah. Well, I remember when it first was released in January of 77, I went and saw it as a 14-year-old. And it was at some little art house in Chicago. And I think there was like 15 people in there, and I don't think it lasted more than a couple of weeks in the theater before it went away. And
sure,
then it caught on later on,
Didn't it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it kind of solidified the name. And that was a film that got more PR in the general media than was reflected by the number of people that saw it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, again, PR is so important anytime you're trying to build brand, and free PR particularly.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you had a background in the movie industry, so you were able to help them out with the lighting and see the problems that they might have had making a film,
Yeah. Yeah. And I had blocked the windows too. The Golds had these great windows on Pacific Avenue on the street. We'd get bounce from the buildings across the street, light through the front windows, and it was great for black and white photography. Like Artie Zeller at the time was the fundamental or prime photographer for Weider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was great for him because he only shot black and white. But for motion pictures, you know, and especially for a documentary where you wanted to catch the guys in action rather than set up a scene, you'd often be hampered, or you would be hampered by any kind of lighting situation like that. You could never shoot into it, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so, fortuitously, I had blocked off those windows. So what that did was provide with Butler's lights up on the ceiling, just the perfect ability to spontaneously shoot. It could catch mm-hmm. anybody anywhere in the gym at a second's notice.
Hmm. Wow, that's great. Now, how long were they in there, Ken? How many months were they in there?
You know, it wasn't a matter of what he'd do was come and go. Like, he'd go ahead and shoot for a couple days, and then he'd be out at the beach maybe, try something else. He'd go to a restaurant and film. But I would think total, his shooting schedule could not have been more than 2 weeks total, include everything
oh, wow.
in California.
Huh. That's great.
But he shot a lot of film. I think he shot 100 hours of film.
Yeah, that's what I read too. So did they know what they were going to shoot, or were they just kind of improvising?
Improvising. They were improvising. They knew when they hit the, for them, they hit the jackpot that, you know, Golds was so available to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think they knew what they were going to, well, they didn't know the exact scene, but they knew they were going to do a lot of shooting in there. And of course, all the guys came, like Corny from San Francisco, you had Arnold, you had Franco and the whole crew in their training for the show, or for the
yeah.
movie, and for the upcoming show. So that was taken care of. But now they did put in some extra scenes later. That's why it couldn't be a true documentary. I mean, Waller hiding the T-shirt, that was one.
Mm-hmm.
And the two throwing a football, that was done afterwards.
Right, right.
Callard, yeah. But no, he really, I think he had the intent of shooting it as a documentary.
Okay.
But he felt that he had to add a couple of manufactured scenes when it got right down to it.
All right, that's it for the show. I hope you guys enjoyed some of these trips down memory lane of some of our old shows on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Next week, we will have part three of our second anniversary show. So I hope you guys enjoy that. In the meantime, thanks to our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Hope everybody's having a great year, and we will see you guys next week. Take care, everybody.